Podcast, the Neil Haley Show, and celebrity interviews live from the Grotto with Greg Hanna. Greg, what's going on, man? How are you?
Doing fantastic, Neil. How about yourself? I'm all excited with your new live streaming. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, it is a total lot of fun. I love it. It's another way to, you know, increase the brand and have fun conversations with people that check it out. And then it just pops up somewhere in video. And 1080 quality. That's the big thing, is having video that's the best quality possible. And I know you're excited about our guest. You know, just to hear his story the first time, having a part two is really exciting. And we're talking in the green room. And so I'm excited to welcome author Brian Cuban, the brother of Mark Cuban. Brian, thanks for stopping by, man. And you're talking about, before we get into questions that Greg has for you, how being an author is a full-time job, and the fact that you have to do a lot of the marketing yourself. You have to be really willing to reach out, because there's so much work involved than just posting on social media and sending an email out to a couple people, right?
Sure. Well, marketing is a full-time job for sure. And I've learned a lot of lessons, and especially if you don't have that, like I said, if you're not Gary Vee or someone and you don't have that massive audience, you're literally selling, you know, in the million person email list, you're literally selling one book at a time. So you have to start 7, 8, 9 months in advance and start your marketing. And a lot of authors don't do that. So they, all of a sudden, they're 2 months before, they posted on Facebook, they posted here or there, and they just don't get the sales they want because they didn't do the work. And a lot of them, they're not willing to do the work, because you have to set shame aside and be willing to take no, and be willing to take, why are you sending me this? You know, don't send me this again. And just let it roll off you to build that opt-in list of people who are opting in specifically for your book, right? And
totally.
I've started early. That's what we were saying. I started early because I have 10,000 LinkedIn connections. I am messaging every single one of those with a synopsis of my book. I'd like you to opt in, because you don't want to spam people. So you have, you know, this is our opt-in reach out, and a lot of them do. And so I do that on Facebook too, where you're going to get a higher percentage of opt-ins, because you have a more intimate relationship. You tend to have a more intimate relationship, you know, online intimate relationship with your Facebook connections. The problem with Facebook is they throttle you. So you have to start early, because you send 100 and they'll shut you down for 3 days.
Right. The rule is, and I've shown where you don't even show a link after you send 50. Here's a tip for you, and we'll get right to Greg's first question, is you basically go ahead, you shoot no link. Then you go into links after that, because they can let you send as many messages. But when you send some sort of link, they nail you. So
yeah, I don't send links. For this time around, I avoided that. I used links from my last book and it was a pain. I avoided that. I just send a message with a synopsis, and I just asked them to opt in, right? So I'm not asking them to buy anything.
I got
it. So what I've done is, now when the book comes out or when it goes into pre-order, rather than going to each person, I have everyone in one place, because I have an opt-in email list.
Yeah, that makes sense, Brian. So Brian, hey, you're a hard-hitting, scrappy entrepreneur, I can tell. Were you born with that? Did you develop that? You know, how did you get there?
I learned a lot of lessons from my brother, Mark. I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I hate no. I'm not a phone guy, you know, where you got to get on the phone and cold call. Although I guess these emails are kind of like cold calling, but no, I've never been that way. I mean, I've always been, been a lawyer, and now I'm a writer. So I hate that stuff. I was not born with the entrepreneur gene like Mark was.
So how are you?
Mark was selling stuff door to door at 15 years old, you know.
yeah, that wasn't you, right? But, you know, what's it like? You know, I mean, your brother's is a famous celebrity entrepreneur. For that group of people that are into the business community that watch Shark Tank, that type of things. I mean, you know, we're not talking Clark Gable level, but we're talking, for a celebrity entrepreneur who's a really well-known guy on the planet. What's that like for you? Do you find it more helpful in your life, less helpful?
I mean, obviously, selling my books, yeah, it's helpful. People know my last name. Last name branding is very important. There are aspects that at one time were annoying. Now nothing annoys me, because I've heard it all. And you know, you get email pitches, send this to your brother Mark, or even from my speaking, you get the email that says, hey, you know, we really like you to come out, but can, you know, we really like for you and Mark to speak together. And, you know, and you know, just say you want my brother Mark to come speak at your event. And the event will have nothing to do with what I do, right?
Yeah.
It's some techie event or some empowerment, right? Speaking empowerment kind of, who's the guy, Tony Robbins, whatever kind of event. And it has nothing to do with what I do, but, you know, you both can speak together. Just come on. I've heard that one before. So you get all those kinds of things, but now I just let it roll off me.
Now, so I wanted to talk about what makes you different with Mark growing up. How are you guys different?
Mark was always outgoing. I was always very shy and very withdrawn, very middle child syndrome. That's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I was very, you know, Mark had a vibrant social circle. I really didn't have any friends. It was, we're all different. We have a younger brother, Jeff. We're all very different people. And that's great.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, speaking of what you just said, you know, Brian, you know, you're a lawyer and, you know, if you want to bring your brother to speak at the Association of Legal Administrators, I know they'd love to hear from both of you.
Why would Mark speak at the Association of Legal Administrators? Yeah. Right. And now I have spoken to the Association of Legal Administrators at two different events. So they know who I am. Well,
that's great.
Yeah, but yeah, I can't imagine Mark would have something to say to the Association of Legal Administrators. I never say no for him, but what I say is you got to email him directly.
Right? Yeah.
I'm not his pitch guy.
If you're his pitch guy, you'd stay even busier, right?
I'm not his
publicist or agent or whatever. Yeah, you're not Mark's
manager. Brother, that's it.
And when you know some of the story, Greg, that's unbelievable about how Rock Bottom Brian hit, which we'll talk a little bit about.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
And that's where we go back to. But I think when you kind of talk about his story, I mean, honestly, at one point, you know, with you going to become a lawyer, you were on the trajectory to be more bigger than Mark at first, right?
No, I don't know. How many lawyers are bigger than Mark?
No, but not Mark. That was Mark then. Like, who it was when you were, how much younger were you when he hit it big time, when he finally sold to Yahoo? Were you already an attorney?
Yes.
Okay. So you were more successful than him for at one point in time.
No, never. Mark was ultra successful well before Yahoo. I mean, you know, how you define success can vary, but in terms of monetary, no. Mark was ultra successful and you know, not a billionaire, but he was very wealthy and did very well before Yahoo. He had a company, you know, we don't want to spend all this on Mark, but yeah. I mean, he sold his first company, Micro Solutions, before, you know, well before Yahoo, and became a millionaire off that. And he was doing well even before that. So
interesting. Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. Next question. Okay.
Yeah. So I would love to have a, you know, as long as you want to do or as short as you want to do, you know, I didn't have the benefit of being able to speak with you prior as Neil has. I would love to hear your story. And I know people listening right now to this live stream or watching it would love to hear it too. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, as many people know, I'm in recovery from cocaine and alcohol addiction, as well as eating disorders. I'll have 17 years in long-term recovery on April 8th. I don't know when you'll wear this, but April 8th of 2024, I'll have 17 years. So I'm very excited about that. And, you know, for me, a much different trajectory than either of my brothers. I mean, I've been to a psychiatric hospital twice. I came close to suicide in 2005. I have three failed marriages, all result from drugs and alcohol. One more, I get a free set of steak knives. So I've been arrested. My trajectory, you know, is much different. Nothing you would really associate with success, right? When we talk about success. But for me, everything began back in childhood. You know, you talk about childhood trauma and the body keeps the score. I was a overweight kid, trending towards obese. Again, the middle of three boys. And Mark was the firstborn, and he, as you might expect, was outgoing, as the firstborns are tend to be those types, selling this door to door, selling that door to door. I remember our local newspapers, there was a printer strike. So both the Pittsburgh Press and the Post-Gazette shut down. he and his buddies drove out to Cleveland, barely old enough to drive, and bought the Cleveland Plain Dealer and bought a bunch of them and drove them back to Pittsburgh and sold them on the street corner in downtown Pittsburgh for twice what they paid. So you kind of knew what he was going to be, right? And he became that and a little bit more. My younger brother, Jeff, was a nationally ranked wrestler, a jock, beer parties, very good looking kid, dates and all the girls, all the things that I associated with love and acceptance, right, that I wanted. I was classic middle child syndrome. I was shy. I was withdrawn. And I internalized anything negative said about me and to me and wore it as who I was, as like a skin tight suit. And I also had a difficult relationship with my mom. And I'll tell you a little bit about this, but I want to make it clear to all of your watchers and listeners that I don't blame my mother for anything I went to. There's a difference between cause and correlation. People can go through difficult things and turn out great, nothing will happen. And other people will go through the exact same things and you'll have mental health issues later in life. That's why it's correlation and not cause. So there was a lot of fat shaming in my house. As I said earlier, I was a heavy kid. My mom used to come home from school in a suburb of Pittsburgh, Mount Lebanon. And I would go into the cabinet and I would pull out the can of Chef Boyardee ravioli or beefaroni or SpaghettiOs. Do they still have that? And I would pull those out and I would take that manual can opener and I'd stick the spoon in and eat it. And my mom would just be gobbling it down. And my mom would come in from selling real estate and she would sometimes walk into the kitchen, not all the time, but it happened enough that I remember it vividly. And she would say, "Brian, if you keep eating that way, you're going to be a fat pig." Now, these were the things my mother's mother said to her. These were the things I'm sure my grandmother said to my, you know, my great-grandmother said to my grandmother in some fashion. Fat shaming as families is often passed down generationally. I'm Jewish, come from an Eastern European Jewish family. My grandmother was from Lithuania, very stereotypical Jewish grandmother focused around food, eat, eat, eat. And unfortunately, she also had a very verbally and mentally abusive relationship with my mother. My grandmother was, according to my mom, a diagnosed schizophrenic. And so they just, you know, my mother grew up to hate my grandmother and right. was always a back and forth. And my mother developed her own mental health issues at a time when in the 70s, when women, you know, couldn't talk about things. There's a stigma today still, but back then, I mean, you couldn't say a word if you were a woman, if you were a mother, you could risk losing your children. So it was kind of just under the current, you know, under the current and hush hush, like it was contagious and spoken about. But not understanding these things, right? Hearing these things from my mom, I grew depressed. And my mother loved me dearly. She loved me dearly. She loved all of us. And people ask me, well, what about Mark and Jeff? You'd have to ask them. I don't know how they experience these things. I don't speak for them. I don't speak for my brothers. I only speak for how I experienced it. And so I grew, you know, even more depressed. I began to eat more Chef Boyardee and I grew to be a bigger Brian and a bigger Brian and got heavier and heavier. And this so often happens as when kids change for what other kids perceive in the negative at school, the bullying started. You know, it happened then and it happens now, although it happens now in a much more insidious way, right? Because you can get bullied over Instagram or Facebook or TikTok or whatever by millions of people you don't know. Back then, it was brick and mortar. You knew who was doing it to you. It was right in your face. Going viral meant 15 kids in the lunchroom knew about it. And so it was a much different time, but you're a product of your times. It didn't hurt any less as you experienced it. And, you know, the kids called me a fat pig and you need to go to Sears and get a bra for your man boobs. And I became the sad clown, really, because I didn't want the kids to know how much it hurt me. And I became very self-deprecating. And let me shut off my phone. I don't know why that's.
We don't hear that one. So don't worry about that.
There. And I'm going to throw my watch over here. So I hung around the popular kids. And in my mind, these kids who were doing the bullying were the popular kids, right? I didn't have Instagram. The popular kids were the kids I saw every day. The kids who were going to the after-school football game, the kids who are going to the concerts together or going to McDonald's and, you know, going to the house parties, the things that I wanted so badly to be invited to, but thought I was too, you know, ugly to ever be included and too much of a reject to ever be included. But I hung around them like on the outside. All of the bullying culminated in what I call the Day of the Gold Pants. Have either of you seen Saturday Night Fever?
Oh, yeah.
So you have John Travolta, remember, in his skin-tight white pants. Well, Mark taught disco, believe it or not. Back, this was 1976, back in when disco was just getting going and Saturday Night Fever had just hit and the soundtrack was, you know, going platinum. And Mark was coming home all the time in these bell-bottom pants, flowers and platform shoes. And one day he gave me a pair of his pants, his disco pants, and they were these shiny gold satin bell-bottom disco pants. He came into my room and he asked me if I wanted them. I said, sure. I mean, I love my brother and he gave me these pants. But Mark wasn't a big guy. The pants fit him fine. I had to jump up and down, spray the water bottle. My butt looked like 15 cats trying to get out, but I didn't care. I wore those pants to school. And the kids made fun of them and my stomach was hanging out. And I'm walking home from school one day with these kids. Again, it was the group of kids who were the bullies, but the popular kids. And so I hung around them and they're in their little group and we're walking on a sidewalk. It's a mile walk from the school to my house along this busy street. And I'm wearing my shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants. And they start making fun of them. And I'm laughing it off. Yeah, I know. You know, you need to take out a belt loop cube and yeah, I'm going to do it when I get home, you know, all that kind of stuff. And one of the kids pulls at the seam where the zipper is, just pulls at it, reaches out and pulls, and it rips. And another kid goes, ooh, he pulls and it rips some more. And within seconds, these kids were on me like a pack of wild dogs. They physically assaulted me on that street, on that sidewalk. They ripped off my pair of shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants that my brother Mark had given me. And they threw the pieces, the shreds, into this busy street. Down to my Fruit of the Loom tighty whities, my three-ring tube socks that you had in the 70s, my Keds tennis shoes, and I had a Pittsburgh Pirates t-shirt on. And they walked down the street high-fiving like kids will do, like they had done the funniest thing ever. I wait for traffic to clear, and I go out and pick up the shreds, and I put them over my tighty whities. And I waddle home. And I'll tell you, that mile walk might as well have been from Pittsburgh to California. That's how long it seemed. And the worst part of it, the absolute worst part of that walk of shame were the stoplights at these busy intersections, because I had to stand there and wait for the light to clear and traffic to stop. And people are looking at me out their window, you know, and their heads go like this, but no one rolled down their window and asked me if I was okay. And I finally got home and I walked downstairs into our basement. The house was empty. It was funeral quiet. And I remember like it was yesterday, the stairs creaked. We had these blue painted old wooden stairs down into the basement and it was a pretty steep decline. And the stairs creaked. And with every creak, I felt it was like ripples on a pond, right? Throwing a rock into the pond where the ripples of the sound went out to my father who ran an auto trim shop about 5 miles away, where he said, you're worthless, you son. And he wouldn't have done that. And it rippled out to my mother, who'd say, I told you so. And, you know, and she wouldn't have done that. She loved me dearly. Rippled out to my brothers, who would say, dude, you can't stand up to bullies. You're not one of us. And of course, they wouldn't have done that. They would have gone and kicked their asses. And I found a garbage can in that basement on that cement floor. And I pulled out the newspapers and the Chef Boyardee cans and all the other stuff. And I put the shreds of these shiny gold pants down at the bottom and covered them up, thinking, okay, that is going to hide my shame. I'll never think about this again. But that's not how trauma works. Trauma threads, trauma remembers. And trauma has a way of coming out for people when you least expect it, in a time of your life when you least expect it. And when you're married, when you're in law school, whatever, and it just, and because it's always under the surface when you don't deal with it. And now, then boom.
Yeah. Now, Brian, why is it that we do not think mental abuse versus physical abuse for children is wrong? why do we not look at specifically anything that's verbal abuse as strong as physical abuse? And
that was 1976.
I still don't think it's happened today. I don't think it's been fixed yet.
Because I'm in that bubble, I see more outreach and more awareness. But you're right, and it's going to depend on, it can depend on so many things, guys. It can be depend on culture. You can be in a culture where it's accepted, right? It can depend on a lot of different, you could be, you might not be growing up in a way that it is talked about within the family unit. And so, there might be a generational avoidance. There are so many factors that come into play that are so varied that it's hard to just generalize. But overall, I can say that I believe just societally, in a societal way, there is more awareness.
There is more, but not enough.
That verbal abuse can cause many, many issues.
Yeah. So, Brian, that was a real painful story. Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure you've said it many times by now. I was hanging on every word and actually there with you, and it was very upsetting. How has that shaped you in your adulthood and in your career at this point?
It had a massive impact on me because, again, cause and correlation are different. I can't say that was the only thing that had an impact. Obviously, I had verbal trauma at home, and other things, verbal trauma at school, physical trauma. I was assaulted. So there are many things, genetics, I was socially awkward as it was. Many things come into play, environmental variable and social variables. But it was right around then when that one thing happened that I first remembered looking at my reflection, seeing a reflection that was basically a monster not worthy of love and who would never be loved, never have a girlfriend. I didn't kiss my first girl till I was in law school. And so I can look at that as a snapshot in time. And I believe that everyone is an accumulation of snapshots, right? Started going back to our earliest memories or even before we remember them, of love, of trauma, of pain, of joy, of happiness, you string those together, to create kind of the framework of who we are that people don't see. They only see what we exhibit outwardly in our Photoshop and face mood Instagram photos of our great life, right? They don't see the snapshots underneath. And so that was the first major snapshot that I remember that sort of began to shape how I saw myself as a human being. And I carried that to Penn State University through the finish of high school and Penn State University, where it really began to manifest itself. And at Penn State University, it's funny, I remember this one event at Penn State. And my father had just driven me up. It was the first day. All the freshmen were unpacking, and I was living in a dorm with three other guys. And my father's helping me unpack, and I'm in the dorm, and I'm staring out this long rectangular window. And it was this cool fall day in Pennsylvania. The leaves are falling off the trees. You could just feel the snap in the air, right? Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania, snap in the air of fall. And like you might feel like maybe in Chicago or somewhere else. And I make eye contact with this curly brown-haired girl who's out in the parking lot with the trunk open of her car, and her parents are talking among themselves. She's talking to this girl next door, and she looks at me, and our eyes meet. And I start sweating. And I imagine my entire life with this girl within a space of 5 seconds. We're going to date, we're going to get married, and we're going to have 2 1/2 children. My life is good now. Everything's good. And I realized in this one sickening moment, I felt it in my stomach. It wasn't a smile, it was a smirk. She turned to her friend just like this. They say something to each other. She turns back to me, puts her hand over her mouth. Ugly, ugly. Now, I'm not the first kid to have a nasty thing said to him, right? It happens all the time. Another kid might have said ugly back. Another kid might have flipped her off, shot her, given her the arm salute. Or we all respond based on how we're socially, genetically, and environmentally programmed. And again, it wasn't her fault either, but I remember that snapshot. And I was somebody who already felt ugly. And you know what my response to that was? Mentally, she's right. She's right. That she is absolutely right. How can I not be ugly? How can I not be ugly? What does a now barely 18-year-old have in his mental health tool chest in 1970, going on 78, going on 1979, you know, back in boomer era? What does that young boy have in his tool chest? What do I have control over? What wrench and screwdriver can fix this?
Totally.
What did I have? My world was out of control. How can I get control?
Wow.
My control was over food. All I had to do, the only thing I had control over was what I put in my mouth, food, eating, right? I eat to live. Well, I associated eating with bullying. So my path to this girl's acceptance, my path to those bullies' acceptance, my path to my mother's love, although she did love me, was to get skinny. And so I began to restrict my food intake. And at 18 years old in 1979, before anybody was talking about it, for men or women, I developed an eating disorder. Before even, do you know who Karen Carpenter was?
Yeah.
Singer for the beautiful drummer and singer for the Carpenters, beautiful voice on Top of the World and many other great song. She would pass away from complications related to anorexia nervosa in 1983. This was 4 years before that. And hers would bring it into the pre-digital national spotlight and kind of, but also cement the stereotype that it as a female disorder. Here, I'm a guy and all I knew is that I would weigh myself obsessively at the school. And every pound that came off, I thought that was a pound towards acceptance. But here's the problem, guys. With every pound that came off, I still looked in the mirror and saw that fat pig monster.
Oh, man.
Or the classroom mirror, the mall mirror, the car mirror. And so that meant I had to lose more weight and more. But the figure never changed. The delusion, the what I saw in my mental delusion never changed. And I eventually transitioned into binging and purging, bulimia. Wow. And every time I binged and purged, I got a feeling of peace, like the next day was going to be okay. But I was engaging in a behavior, again, that I had no name for, I didn't understand. But it gave me this 2 seconds feeling of peace when I engaged in that act. But when the peace went away, in swept the shame of engaging in this weird thing that people just don't do, right? You don't go to the bathroom, the community bathroom, and flush the toilet and throw up so people can't hear it after you binged a meal. And it was shameful. It was shameful because I instinctively knew guys just couldn't do that. You know what? But I had to. I had to, because every time I did it, I felt like the next day everything would be okay. Right. And then came the drinking. I started drinking because it wasn't making me feel any better. So I started drinking to dull my, so I didn't have to feel at all. And by the time I was 21, going into my sophomore year at Penn State, or into my junior year, I was a full-blown alcoholic. I was drinking every night. I was going to the bars by myself on campus. I turned 21 and I was old enough to drink. So I would go to the government control. They still control the alcohol in Pennsylvania, right? You have to go what's called a state store. And I would go to the state store and I would buy these little bottles of tequila and I would go out into the main street and to the alley where all the bars are at Penn State and University Park. And I would swig the tequila so I could get drunk in the hope it would change me into someone different and meet girls and things. But it didn't. It only made me feel worse. And I would go into the bar and get drunker and I would end up just miserable. And there was this vicious cycle. The closest I ever came at Penn State to any epiphany that I had a problem was walking into a hamburger joint, drunk, of course. And I came across this rack of pamphlets that the 12-step groups put out. And for those who don't know 12-step, for the most well-known one for alcohol is AA, but there are others. There's 12-step for drugs and all kinds of, even 12-step for eating disorders and all other groups. But it was a rack of pamphlets called the 20 Questions. and it was geared towards college students. Do you black out? Do you miss class? And I'm checking off yes to all these questions. They give you a number to call. And all I did was I crinkled it up. I threw it in the trash basket, thinking I'm a college student. We all did this, do this. That's as close as I ever came.
Oh my goodness.
And that was the trajectory into my young adulthood, into alcoholism.
Wow. You know, Brian, let's quickly talk about your first crime novel and then the second, and then Greg has his final question.
Okay. Yeah, we ran out of time, but that also led to cocaine addiction and two trips to a psychiatric hospital, a near suicide attempt, and all kinds of problems. But yeah, let's go.
All right. So let's talk about latest books. Go ahead with the first one out, and then the second one's coming out.
I've written four books, actually. My first book was self-published. It was a memoir well ahead of its time called Shattered Image. It was about my struggle with body image, which I am going to rewrite in 2025 for a new audience. The second book I wrote was my more traditional memoir that's more well-known, called The Addicted Lawyer, Tales of the Bars, Booze, Blow, and Redemption, which outlines my struggles as a lawyer with drugs and alcohol. And then my first novel was called The Ambulance Chaser, set in Pittsburgh, about a lawyer falsely accused of the murder of a high school classmate 30 years prior. And he goes on the run to try to, across the country, to try to find the one person who can prove his innocence. In my current novel, my most recent crime thriller that will be released in December of this year is called The Body Brokers. And it centers around the fentanyl overdose crisis. It is the same character from The Ambulance Chaser who goes to pick up his girlfriend for their anniversary and finds her dead of a fentanyl overdose. But he suspects that she is murdered. And he travels into the kind of the belly of the beast, travels to Philadelphia, the Kensington area of Philadelphia, to prove she was murdered. And this centers around that.
Wow. It's a lot of stuff going for you. All right, Greg, I know the final question.
Really good. So Brian, I ask every guest this question, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your answer, because I'm sure we can all learn quite a bit from your answer. So here we go, Brian. Tell me, what do you feel is the most important thing in life you've ever learned?
Take things one moment at a time. Particularly my sobriety. You know, the other thing that it took me a long time to learn, especially with my last name, is people are going to think you suck. You have to get over it. And you can't, you know, what people think of me is none of my business. And I used to let it bother me. And, now it just rolls off. I can't tell you, if I had a dollar for every time someone said, you know, you're only selling books, or you're only this or that because you're Mark Cuban's brother. Well, yeah, okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Next.
But the thing is, you're putting the effort. He's working hard, Greg, to get to where he wants to go. And I think the thing that you want, and also with your books, is to go out and speak to people about addiction.
I speak publicly about addiction. I speak at law firms. I just spoke at a college, High Point University out in North Carolina. I speak yearly. I do a lot of public speaking about addiction.
You definitely bring that inspiration that people can overcome those things, for sure. And best place to go.
We do recover. Recovery is possible. It follows a different trajectory, and there are detours, and there are often steps backwards. It's rarely a straight line. But and that's especially important in an era where we are going to set another record for fentanyl overdose fatalities.
Will these books be movies ever, or series?
The Ambulance Chaser has been optioned. The screenplay is now complete, and we are going to be pitching it soon.
See, there you go. Then you're going to be, it'll be a different trajectory for Brian Cuban compared to your brother, and you never know.
Mark's been in a few films, we'll see. Getting optioned and actually getting somebody to put up the money to make the movie are two different things. So we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, fantastic. We appreciate it. Best place is your website, right? For people to find it.
www.briancuban.com.
All right. We thank you, sir.
Yeah,
all right.
That was
a great talk. That was a special simulcast, the Neil Haley Show and Celebrity Interviews, live from the Grotto. Greg Hanna, guys, take care.